There's a condition called Taijin Kyofusho Scale, or TKS, that affects Japanese people almost exclusively. It's a mental health condition where the person experiencing it believes they're offending others simply by their presence. Maybe they believe themselves to have terrible body odor, or that their personality is so disruptive that it's evident to others even when they're just sitting in the corner. But tell a psychologist in Canada that you think you're experiencing TKS, and they'll likely have to spend some time looking it up to figure out what you're talking about. Likewise, tell a psychologist outside North America that you're worried about anorexia, and you might get a similar reaction. Different cultures experience different mental health conditions, and because psychology has long been a Western-dominated profession, with Western-centric study populations and practitioners, it's only recently that psychologists have researched cultural differences in a concerted and intentional way. And of course, no culture is a monolith. A Japanese person in Canada may have come from a Japanese culture, but they're now experiencing Canadian culture as well. Both those things will have influence over their mental health. Nuance then becomes a key to a culturally competent interaction between that person and the healthcare system. The historical Western normative approach to mental health has led many groups, in particular Indigenous communities, to feel left out of the discussion and to harbor a logical mistrust of the mental health system. And they are not the only ones. My name is Eric Bowman. I'm the communications person at the Canadian Psychological Association, and this is Mindful. Now, I brought up cultural differences in psychology here to illustrate the idea of Western normativity in healthcare, and mental health in particular. This affects people of almost all minority groups and marginalized groups in particular. But one group is particularly at risk, and that is gender diverse people. Not only do they contend with a Western normative system that might not acknowledge or know much about gender diversity and fluidity in cultures where it's much more normalized and accepted, but they have to contend with the cis-normativity of the healthcare system as well. A system built by cisgendered people, tested on men and women, reinforced by data from gender binary studies only, and one that carries with it another bias imported to North America with the rest of Western culture. That is the notion that gender diverse people either don't exist, or that they have something intrinsically wrong with them. Today we're going to dive into the reason for cis-normativity in healthcare, the dangerous effects this has on the gender-diverse community, and what dismantling that structure might look like. The CPA publishes a magazine called Synopsis, and our most recent issue is about gender diversity. Check the show notes to read that issue online. And joining me today are two psychologists who contributed the bulk of the content for that issue.
I'm Jesse. I use they, them pronouns. I'm a clinical psychologist. I work in Ontario, in Quebec, and in New Brunswick. Most of my work involves working with gender diverse people, transgender people. In the context of that work, I've also had the pleasure of working with the CPA in preparing a policy statement that was released not too long ago, over the spring 2023. So a policy statement on gender diversity and human rights. And I would say that's kind of like, that would be representative of most of the work that I do is around that population.
Françoise Susset, I'm a psychologist. I use she, her pronouns, elle in French. And I've been working in the field of trans health, gender diversity for a long time, actually about 25 years. And I wouldn't say I fell into it, but I became intrigued with the topic when parents brought this six-year-old to my office, and I started looking at the literature, and this was in the 90s, and I was a bit appalled at what I was reading at the time. This was still a very conservative approach of, you know, sort of forcing the child to play with quote-unquote gender-appropriate toys. This was the era also of ignoring the child if they weren't choosing to play with the proper toys. So it's like not our most glorious period in terms of trans health. And so, and not even trans health, but just gender-diverse behaviors and interests. So we weren't even talking about trans health. So this sort of piqued my interest, and I started getting involved more and more in the field. So I've been a psychologist for over 30 years and have been interested in minority stress as it impacts mental health. I've been interested also and worked in trauma. So I'm what's called today trauma-informed therapists, so PTSD, DID, et cetera, which unfortunately comes in handy working with marginalized populations. I say unfortunately because a lot of the trauma that people experience is related to the social situation and socioeconomic situation coming from a marginalized population. But I am very interested in that intersection between social issues and its impact on mental health and also on development. So that's been a long, long time. And then I worked for the Ministry of Health and Social Service in Quebec doing trainings. This was around the HIV crisis, working at sensitizing people on LGB issues, the sexual orientation issues, as the research was emerging in the 90s that much of the risk, many of the risk factors had to do with social issues, homophobia, marginalization, et cetera. So I was actually doing trainings with a group of excellent trainers across Quebec in the health and social service area and in the education sector, so schools, et cetera. And then eventually decided to develop the Institute for Trans Health, which Jesse is part of, so that we could really focus on working at sensitizing the health and social service and education sector to the needs of trans and gender diverse, non-binary and gender diverse folks. So this is where we are now. And Jesse and I collaborate on several fronts, including we co-lead a clinical supervision group. And we're actually in the midst of preparing our next training, which is gonna be on addressing issues related to detransition, which is a big preoccupation in society in general, in the media. And so we kind of want to train clinicians so that they're well prepared and understand, know how to work with people who might be putting into question their transition. So I guess that's kind of it.
That's it in a nutshell, right? Good.
I don't do nutshell very well, as you may have already figured out. So I apologize in advance.
That is okay. And we are going to talk about the detransitioning idea and how that affects people in next week's episode. This week, I wanted to focus on what you guys were talking about in our latest issue of Synopsis, which is cis normativity in healthcare. And Francoise, you mentioned, you know, being interested in the intersection of social issues and mental health, which is kind of what we're doing here on this podcast as much as I can. In this idea that an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. So it's all well and good for psychologists to, you know, who work in a clinical space to help people who are experiencing mental health issues as a result of a number of factors. But the researchers who look into those factors and figure out a way to, you know, reduce poverty, for example, you know, reduce the effects of climate change, that sort of thing, can help prevent some of those issues from occurring. And so that's kind of where I'm coming from in this circumstance. When we talk about cis normativity, though, I'm hoping you guys, maybe Jesse, can you define what cis normativity means? I think most people know what cisgender means, but the idea that our healthcare system is built around cis normativity. And when we put out that position paper you were referring to, one of the main thrusts of that was the healthcare system itself and how it treats gender diverse people. So cis normativity in that system, what does that look like and what does it mean?
Yeah. So when we talk about cis normativity, it refers to a belief system and assumptions that everybody is cisgender. So that means everybody identifies with the sex that they were assigned at birth and that there's no other options, basically. So it's that assumption that there's only cisgender people that exist, transgender people don't exist, gender diverse people don't exist. And it's also a system or a set of beliefs that will privilege cisgender identities and disadvantage anyone who's not cisgender, basically. So when you're cisgender, you benefit from cisgender privilege. You feel concerned and addressed in society. We talk to you in a way that's respectful of your identity. You recognize yourself in media. You recognize yourself as you're navigating your life on a day-to-day basis. In a way, it's almost like when you're a cisgender person living in cis-normative world, It's like the gender doesn't exist in a way. It's smooth for you, right? It's smooth sailing. It's comfortable. Whereas if you're a gender diverse person, you're going to encounter obstacles every step of the way. Everything you try to navigate, you encounter those little obstacles, little or big obstacles, basically, where you're kind of, the message that's being sent is like, there's no box for you on this questionnaire, right? You don't fit here. Mm-hmm. We didn't really design the system with you in mind. We don't really know what to do with you. This is kind of inconvenient for us that you don't fit in this box. So it's, that's always kind of like the message that's being sent. And so that cis normativity can, you know, look like microaggressions on one end. So maybe more subtle form of cis normativity, and it could be explicit cis normativity to a level of violence in a way that, you know, you're facing hostility, discrimination, or violence and aggression on the basis of being a gender diverse person.
This reminds me, the very first person that I interviewed when I first started at the CPA, his name is Conrad Chakowski, presumably still is. And he was doing a study at the University of Ottawa, and his thesis was how to include gender diverse people in research projects, because research projects for the longest time were very binary. Okay, here's our data set for men, here's our data set for women, and if you don't fit in those boxes, well, we kind of exclude you from the study because there are so few people who fit those boxes. And also, maybe, you know, out of 1,000 people that we surveyed, there are two, and one of them is non-binary and the other one is female trans, and how do we put them into the study in the end? So his research was all about trying to find a way to be more inclusive of that community in research. And I've been bugging him ever since to, you know, come back with the findings of that study and where we can go from there. But of course, everything's a very slow process. So that's something that I think mm-hmm. is specifically in psychology and in research, people have been dealing with for a long time. Yeah, Francoise?
Well, I mean, and you're bringing up a very important example for me in my mind in medicine. So ignoring gender diversity has deadly impacts. And I'll give you a very concrete example. The CDC was collecting information, has been collecting information on HIV and the rate of HIV infections, et cetera, not considering the possibility that who they have under male and who they have under female, or men and women, may include people who are trans. And so what happens then is that the statistics that they come up with are completely skewed. And in terms of the pop, we found out sometime in the 2000s that actually when you did pay attention and you did include the data having to do with gender diversity, that, for example, in certain sectors of certain cities, we had astronomical rates of infection, namely, for example, for trans women who are sex workers. And then in other segments of the population, you had almost a zero rate for trans women who had no at-risk sexual behaviors. So then you go to the prevention programs, and you have prevention programs for men that don't include men who have different anatomies, right? So trans men who might still have a vaginal cavity. You don't include information in medicine in general for women who have a prostate, because vaginoplasties don't remove a prostate. So then the prostate needs to be followed and examined the same way that a male would be. We have multitude of examples of the very real and sometimes deadly impact of ignoring gender diversity in our research. I believe that the CIHR has come out with some recommendations around research that any research project should include this dimension, should be based on gender diversity, and not just research that pertains to trans folks or gender diverse folks or non-binary folks, but in general, any research that's done should be inclusive of this diversity, because the impacts are too great to ignore it.
Yeah, Jesse.
Yeah, I would add, you know, this is what we're seeing in the research world, but we can think about how this shows up in the medical world or in the clinical world for psychologists. So when we don't have the appropriate words to allow people that are gender diverse to identify themselves, a lot of the times what will happen is they won't disclose, right? That sends the message, it's not safe here, right? we haven't really done our homework of deconstructing our own cis normativity here, so it doesn't feel safe. So a lot of gender diverse people will err on the safe side and won't disclose. And so what that means is that we completely miss out on all of the information relevant to that. So how are we supposed to work in the best interest of our clients if we don't even know something that's so deeply fundamental about themselves? Right. So it's in the forms, it's in the way, you know, the boxes that we check or whatnot, but it's also the person in front of you, who, if you're sending out that message that it's not really safe to talk about this, or we haven't really considered you, we haven't really made space for you to exist here, then it's the very basic of forming a trust bond with people. And so in healthcare, that's really, really important. We know that one of the big consequences from that is that gender diverse people will actually avoid seeking healthcare when they need it, whether it has, you know, whether it's related to trans health or not. Trans and gender diverse people will avoid seeking healthcare for that very reason. It's not a welcoming space for a lot of folks, unfortunately.
So I think Jesse's also referring to the TransPulse Ontario study that from many years ago now is TransPulse Canada that's wrapping up. But TransPulse Ontario that really gave us some pretty alarming data about the lack of consulting in emergency rooms. So we're talking about medical emergencies, presumably mostly medical emergencies, maybe psychiatric emergencies, where people just do not go, because they don't feel that they will be, they feel they'll be doing worse afterwards. And unfortunately, Jesse and I both have numerous examples of clients who have consulted in ERs and have come out of the ERs in worse shape than when they went in, especially when it's for psychiatric emergencies. So there's this avoidance of the healthcare system. And oftentimes we feel like somehow people need to come out to us. And the problem here is that, or the challenge here is that there are many trans folks who have no intention of letting you know this unless there's an environment. And even when there's an environment that's welcoming, we have to adapt. We have to have a perspective of universal access that is inclusive of everybody. So, for example, on medical, the many clinics in the States and hospitals have, instead of just checking male or female or man or woman on a medical in a medical system, it actually bypasses that idea of identity into body reality. So in a medical context, for example, you have organ lists and organ inventories that people check. But that's not just useful for trans folks. If I'm a cisgender woman who's had a hysterectomy and ovarectomy, then that might be also useful to say, you know, do you have a uterus? Do you have ovaries? Right? Do you have breasts? Do you have so looking at inventory actually creates a universal access. It's just one example for everybody, not just for trans and non-binary folks. And also because the identity piece is not necessarily informing the clinician of what the body reality is, right? Somebody can identify as trans, have had zero surgery, or has had surgery but is not taking hormones, or right. So it's the idea of universal access that I think needs to guide us. And we did this with HIV, by the way, right? Remember, maybe back to a time, I'm old, so I have old references, but I remember a time when in the ERs and hospitals were really worried, should we just test everybody that comes into our ER to see if they're HIV positive? And then all of a sudden, not all of a sudden, but at some point they got the idea that no, we're just going to act as if everybody could potentially be infected. So we're going to protect ourselves. And if we have a needle prick, we're going to go get tested. And right. So everybody who came into the system was treated the same way. And I think coming back to the idea of cisnormativity, it's the idea of expanding our concept of gender so that our systems, medical and other, are welcoming regardless of the person's gender identity and physical reality.
Jesse, you mentioned using specific terminology as part of this inclusive approach. And, you know, I have long fought against the use of acronyms of all kinds on this podcast. Francoise, you mentioned the CDC, Centers for Disease Control, for those who may not know, and the CIHR, the Canadian Institute for Health Research, I think, right? Too many acronyms. I have to deal with them all day. But you guys used one in this article in Synopsis, which I hadn't seen before, 2SNBGD, which I think is an important one because I haven't seen that before. And I think that's two-spirited, non-binary, gender diverse. So this is, you know, for a long time, I think we've used this 2SLGBTQ, which people sort of think of as, you know, gay and lesbian and bisexual, but they don't think about the T part of that and all the rest of it. And it sort of lumps all of that together. This is an acronym solely for people with, you know, gender diversity concerns. Is that something that is a well-known acronym in that community? Is that something that, you know, will catch on and that we'll start using more often, do you think?
That's a good question. I mean, vocabulary moves pretty quickly within the community. It changes pretty quickly. And that's a good thing, actually. It's the community, you know, self-defining, which is good. I think we're starting to see the acronyms like this one more and more for a very specific reason. And that's recognizing that the reality of gender diverse people is different than the reality of sexual minorities. So lesbian, gay, bisexual, pansexual, like when we're talking about sexual orientation, the reality is different of, let's say, people who would identify as being gay, lesbian, but cisgender versus people that are transgender, gender diverse, non-binary. It's a bit of a different reality. That's not to say that these identities can't overlap. Of course, they often do. But we've been seeing a lot of the kind of amalgamating everybody together, and that kind of dilutes a little bit of the specific needs of gender diverse people. So that's the intention behind using that acronym. I have seen it, you know, being used more and more. I think as we're becoming more and more aware of the reality of gender diverse folks and wanting to address their specific needs and the specific like systemic shortcomings around that population, the more we're going to see that acronym pop up.
Francoise, you were talking about this idea of inclusive care that, you know, for example, would have this checklist. I do have a prostate. I don't have a uterus. I do have two lungs and a spleen and so on. And you go down that, which sort of takes away the gender binary notion. Also doesn't require that person to put themselves in a specific box. I am non-binary. Right. What else might there be that makes healthcare more accessible, right? That sort of mitigates the cis normativity that's permeated that area for a long time. Maybe some other concrete examples of what we can do in our healthcare system to alleviate the sort of historical momentum that's led us to this point.
Education. So, no, people come to the hospital for blood tests, and the nurse comes into the waiting room and calls out the wrong name because the name's not changed officially on the papers. The person's not going to get up because they're calling for Julie and the person looks like a Julian. And so what happens is the person sits there, the nurse turns back and goes, I guess they didn't, or they left. Right? So the person isn't going to have their blood test. So education at the most basic level, for example, coming into a healthcare system, hoping to be assessed in order to access hormone therapy, right? So who's doing the welcoming and who's doing the triage? So we have an issue in Quebec that oftentimes, not always, not everywhere, it's changing slowly, much too slowly, but it's changing. People will come into the public health system and say, well, I want hormones because, you know, I want to be assessed because I'm trans and I want to begin a medical transition. And so they'll be put on a waiting list that usually lasts about 2 years to see a psychologist. And then they'll see the psychologist and the psychologist will say, well, I don't know anything about trans health. You need to go somewhere else. Where? I don't know where, but you need to not be in my office because I can't help you. And the person's waited 2 years on the waiting list because that's kind of the average 1 to 2 years in our system currently, which is really another discussion for another time. And so the person's at risk because, again, the trans, I'll refer to the TransPulse Ontario study because so much important data came out of it. But one of the things that we know is that waiting period is a high risk period for all sorts of issues for the person. Mental health issues, mainly depression, suicidality, et cetera, are really at a very, very high level. And so this is a high risk period, and the person's on a waiting list, and waiting and waiting and waiting sees the person who can't help them. So education at that level also, because what I'm talking about is the triage level. This person at triage doesn't understand that this is not primarily a mental health issue, that this is a medical issue, and the request is for a medical assessment for hormones, because physicians are able to, especially when we talk about adults, are able to, if they have the education, meet with the person and go through the informed consent process and find out a little bit more about them, et cetera, and start the process of getting them what they want within months, not within years. And so education for the physicians, education for the people at triage. And a lot of times what I find unfortunate is that things block at the most basic level. The receptionist that in the department, the medical department or the mental health department, who doesn't call out the right name. So these things are so, Jesse was talking about microaggressions, are so problematic. And so we know, we're therapists, right? We see clients in our office, we have for years, for decades, who come in after these experiences and they're in pieces. It's you know, the trans woman who's on her way to work and goes to the convenience store to buy something and gets misgendered at the even though she's been on hormones for a year, and even though she's dressed and in a skirt and makeup and gets misgendered because no, she's not necessarily looking absolutely convincing at this point, if that's even her goal, because that's a whole other discussion. But she gets misgendered after all that, and she just goes home and calls in sick because it's so demoralizing, you know. And so education, sensitization, it's happening in ways that are mixed, some positive, some negative. All this attention brought to gender diversity is having also some very damaging and sometimes deadly impact. We see the rise of transphobia, the violence that's directed at gender diverse folks. We see these policies that are being developed in school settings. We see the media that is coming out with very biased and very wrong information. We saw this recently with New Brunswick, with the Mr. Higgs, Prime Minister Higgs, and being completely misinformed about youth. So, yeah, you know, this is having huge impact, and it's having a huge impact on our clients' mental health, because they're really feeling like there's no room for them in society.
Yeah, I think that, and tell me if you think of this any differently though, but I think that New Brunswick example is a great one. But I actually read that example as a suggestion that at least within the province of New Brunswick, most healthcare providers actually get it. So the premier cites this study and he says 60% of people are put on hormones immediately after having their first meeting and so on. And he brings in a psychologist from the United States to echo those same sentiments to also deliver this false information. And the author of that study had to come out and specifically correct them and say, no, they've seen an average of 3 doctors and healthcare professionals already before they get to that. That's 60% of people who get to the point where they can go to see the person who will be prescribing the hormones. And it's a year wait and it's all this. Like, nothing about what you've said is true. But the fact that he had to go and find a psychologist who was willing to parrot this from the United States indicates to me that he can't find one in New Brunswick, that he can't find somebody right there who's going to be able to back him up on this fraudulent claim, right? That strikes me as, and I felt in a way that sort of meant progress, bringing in a weird external expert. And there's a lot of American states that do this too, when they want to pass, anti-trans laws. We'll bring it. There's one Canadian guy who goes out there and, you know, for a fee will tell people that everything's terrible and whatever, right? So you really have to search for the person who's willing to compromise their ethics in that way. Am I off base, or is it like?
No, you're not off base. I like your optimistic perspective of it's good news that they can't find anybody close by. I'll go with that. That's a much happier kind of conclusion. Yeah, I think really someone has to go out of their way. But the problem is that these people are very vocal and they're not hard to find. And so what's happening, yes, and it's not just in New Brunswick, it's happening in other provinces as well, is that these people are brought in to support prejudice, essentially, to support misinformation, to support fears. So I'll be fair. I think that there's a lot of fear. I think that a lot of what we see in terms of transphobic and cisnormative kinds of reactions are based in fear. And fear is based in lack of understanding and lack of knowledge, which is why Dr. Greta Bauer that you mentioned came out. And even though she's at the University of Minnesota now, but she is the head, the lead researcher for TransPulse, TransPulse Ontario, TransPulse Canada, and Trans Youth Can, which is the study that was misquoted. So, and that I'm part of also marginally because we're one of the centers where the data was collected at the Meraki Health Center in Montreal. So, you know, she had to come out and say, you know, this is not what we said in our study. These kids actually have waited years and have seen 2 to 3 professionals before they even get to. And this is a study of kids who actually make it to the 10 clinics that were part of the study across Canada, right? So we're not talking, this is a minority of kids. We're not talking about all the youth. I shouldn't say kids because that's part of the confusion. These are adolescents. Nobody mm-hmm. prescribes anything to children. So we need to get away from that language, and I need to. So these are youth, these are adolescents, and many don't make it to our clinics, and our clinics have waiting lists, and you know it's not simple. Provinces where kids or adolescents can't access care unless they're 16, unless they have parent consent. In Quebec, it's 14. So sometimes we do get youth who come on their own initiative, but many provinces that's not the case. So you first have to get the parents on board. Many of us, also many therapists, counselors, etc., that are trans affirming, that understand the issues, that can talk to parents, many of us are not in the public system. Many of us are in private practice because the public system hasn't really caught up, at least in Quebec, to training people. And even when we do train people, psychologists, sexologists, social workers that work in the public system, oftentimes they're not allowed to do trans health, to see these populations in the public system. So there are blockages at every level. And so a lot of the youth, the numbers for the study are only the youth who actually were seen in these clinics. There are many other youth who will not be seen anywhere and who have to live with the profound distress of a body that's developing in a way that is so painful for them. And that creates all sorts of other issues, of course, as we can imagine.
For sure. And Jesse, I saw you were about to say something, and I'm sorry, I think I cut you off. We have 3.5 minutes left. I'm going to leave the last word to you.
So I think a good way of kind of encapsulating everything that we talked about here, a key takeaway would be that dismantling cisnormativity in healthcare leads to positive health outcomes for everyone. For trans people, for cis people, for everybody. It prevents medical mistakes, medical errors, and it recognizes the humanity of everyone. So it's good for everyone.
Absolutely. And I encourage everybody to read the article that you guys have put in Synopsis. In fact, all the articles you guys have put in Synopsis. Jesse, Francoise, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. And we'll have you right back on for next week's episode, where we talk about detransitioning, the realities, the myths, and the actual process that might happen in that circumstance. So thank you both so much, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Be sure to check the show notes for links to the gender diversity issue of Synopsis, where both Francoise and Jesse contributed a lot of writings that help illuminate these issues further. Now be sure to tune in next week as we continue this conversation with a discussion about detransitioning, one of the big scare tactics of people trying to enact anti-trans legislation or trying to implement school policies that erase gender diverse kids. Is the notion that many people regret making a transition and that this process is irreversible. The notion basically is that if we don't let anyone transition or let them know that doing so is possible, then no one will regret having done it. Well, that's sound logic, but what of the damage that's done along the way? Next week, Jesse and Francoise will explain and pre-bunk some of the myths that you are sure to hear in the coming years as this anti-trans disinformation campaign continues. This week, I want to thank Francoise and Jesse for their expertise, Jamie Montgomery for producing today's episode, Dave Taylor for providing the theme song Avenues, and you at home for streaming, downloading, and following along. Mindful is written, hosted, published, and scheduled by me, Eric Bowman, and I look forward to picking up where we left off next week.